Manager involved in running SharePoint or a business owner of sorts? Okay. Developers? A few. This isn't a, well, it kind of is a dev talk, but it's more businessy and IT pro focused today. But there is some stuff in there that will relate to the developers later on in the in the session.
Business, I'll have a business.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. So I'll do these two in an intro. You doing this?
Yeah, say it. What I want you to say is just say before you go,
Guys, can I ask you again just to move in because there's a lot more people trying to get in the room? We're just close to the wall.
There's an empty seat next to you.
They don't buy it. They may buy it.
There's space on the floor at the front of here.
We supply bean bags. If you get a photo of that.
Yeah.
There's two down the front here. Really? Is everyone sick of this song yet? Our marketing director was like, let's do one of these for YouTube. And I'm like, no. No, we're not. There's some really comfy floor space down the front here. There's one, two there. One here, right at the front.
One at the front here as well.
One at the front. These guys are baiting. They're trying to see whether there's going to be a good session so they can bail quick. There's a few up here, guys, if you want to walk through before I start. Okay, we good? 5:30? Cool. Okay, well, thank you for coming. Thanks for being patient and finding yourself a seat. My name is Jeremy Thake, and this is Garth Luke. Today, we're going to be talking about presenting SharePoint as a service back to your organization. So I got a bit of a feel for you guys in terms of who had SharePoint here and what the kind of the roles and responsibilities are within the room. If you could leave questions to the end of the session, in the Q&A, we do have an hour of 15, so we've got an hour of the session, then 15 minutes to fire away at questions. That'd be great. So try and keep them up there so you can ask at the end, because we are going to tell a story all the way through. And sometimes if you throw a hand up early in the session, we'll answer it in the next few slides anyway. So if you can hold them to the end, that'd be great. There are some more seats up the front, guys, if you want to walk to the front. So we thought we'd have some fun here, and rather than introduce ourselves, just so you get an idea about who we are, we were going to introduce each other. So I'll let Garth take the reins, and he can have a go at trying to introduce me.
Great. Well, Jeremy is very handsome, as you can see. He's a SharePoint MVP and has been for how many years now?
3 years.
3 years. He lives in New York for his sins. He's been working for AvePoint for about a year. Was actually originally based in Perth, and we shipped him off to New York because we thought he was quite intelligent, and we thought we'd take a piece of him. He recently was involved he's involved in our labs team in New York and built one of the first five apps that was in the SharePoint 13 store called MyView. You can go check it out. He recently appeared on the stage with some senior Microsoft execs at TechEd EMEA, talking about Windows as Azure and how AvePoint has integrated with Windows Azure. So that was quite a big thing for Jeremy, I think, when was it, 3 months ago?
Yeah, sure,
pretty
yep.
Cool. And if you know the site nothingbutsharepoint.com, Jeremy is actually the founder of nothingbutsharepoint.com. So he's very involved in the community. You might see him. He's absolutely crazy on social every 5 seconds. So some good stuff if you want to follow him on Twitter. He's got some good information that he shares there as well.
I was a little bit worried he'd be a bit more nasty than that. Thanks, Garth.
I could have been.
So Garth has actually been with the company now, or AvePoint, for how long?
4 years.
4 years. So he's worked with AvePoint, mainly running the Australian office, and he moved to California to run our California office as well. So he does just about as much commuting as I do to conferences to come keep his team in shape. He plays golf a lot. Does anyone recognize what golf course that is? Have I heard any golfers in the room? No, I didn't either. But we were meant to make a really big thing about it being at...
It's Pebble Beach, man.
Pebble Beach. So he's just trying to show off there. He has a beautiful wife. She's lovely. She's not with him right now. She's stuck in California. Stuck being the adverse word. And believe it or not, golf was actually a rock star prior life of IT. If you go search for him on YouTube, embarrassingly, he used to wear a lot of makeup and was in a punk band. And he was actually a very good guitarist. So, again, he is on Twitter and Facebook. And any questions, please ping us on emails afterwards. Or, again, ask us at the end of the Q&A if you want to do that at the end here. So we're going to jump straight into it. In terms of just setting kind of the expectations of what we're presenting today, we really want to talk about what the problem is essentially within organizations with using SharePoint. But more importantly, why has that not changed? Sorry. We want to talk about the problem, but we also want to talk about kind of drawing those lines between IT and the business and setting expectation about what we see there in the field. And then we're going to talk about some of the services. So the whole concept of this is providing SharePoint as a service back to the organization. So we're going to talk about what we see in the field from a services perspective. So if you're an IT person and you don't want to manage the entire stack of SharePoint, you want to stop at really keeping the lights on and let the business own the top part of the SharePoint stack, we're going to show you what kinds of services are required inside there and what we typically see businesses rolling out first off. And then as a last section there, we really wanted to not just establish this as a way forward, but more importantly, establish it as a way of measuring your success of SharePoint. A lot of times I get asked at conferences, you know, how do we prove to the business that, you know, well, you've given us all this money to buy SharePoint as a technical solution, but it's more about how we prove there's been a return on the investment as a business solution. So we just wanted to highlight some of the ways that people typically do return on the investment measures, but also we want to highlight some of the ones that may be a bit more effective for your organization, and we'll talk about some of the problems there. So to start with, we're going to actually identify some of the key problems that we see in the space, just to really set the scene about what happens when you introduce SharePoint into your organization. Now, not necessarily as an IT pro problem, more of the business level focused problems that you see within SharePoint. So with that, essentially I'm going to hand over to Garth, who's going to talk about some of those key issues that we see within that space.
So yeah, thanks Jeremy. One of the things that's really important, I think, from an IT perspective is before we get into actually delivering, you know, this platform of SharePoint to the business, we really need to get into the head of the business and really understand some of the challenges and the way they think. I mean, at the end of the day, I think one of the challenges in any organization is that I see when I talk to big organizations is I see a very big disconnect between what the business actually is trying to achieve and what the platform is actually delivering to the business. So first of all, one of the most important things is having accountability. The business wants to have accountability in place. That may come in form from a business perspective as in a governance committee, having representation, you know, across the business, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But really making sure that, you know, that like I say, the platform is driving real value to the business. And then looking down at a more granular level, we're going to, obviously, the business wants to know from a site and site collection perspective, you know, who owns a site? You know, that's a question that needs to be answered for the business, as well as is the site being accessed or used? I think there's a lot of sprawl of sites that just sit out there, and we don't really know who owns them or who uses them regularly. Next thing is quality. You know, is a site still active? We want to have a way to actually measure ourselves and make sure that we are continuing to deliver value to the business. So from a site perspective, is a site still active? Is the content accurate in the site? And is it still relevant to the business? Restrictions. You know, make sure we have a good policies in place. You know, make sure we prevent sharing of confidential information, for example. So making sure those restrictions are in place to help set up that model for the business. From a compliance perspective, you know, is there potentially any classified information that is of high risk to the business that is sitting in places that it shouldn't be? The business cares a lot about that as well. The next one is appropriateness, making sure we know who has access to what.
I'm surprised that image got approved by the scrubbing team.
But one of the important things, you know, there's several levels of appropriateness. It's not just about people having access to the right things, but is the content that's out there sitting in the appropriate place as well? And then discoverability. There's no point in having the sprawl of content and sites and all that out there if the search results that we get for that content are not relevant, so making sure that's actually architected correctly. And another thing is, quite often I think, and I even see this a lot on our internal site and something we're working on internally, is, you know, when I want content, do I actually know where to go and find it? And that's really important to make sure we can deliver that as well. And then from an infrastructure and storage perspective, you know, I think a really big challenge, and we will talk a lot more about this a little later on, but you know, how do I manage my storage growth? Most often we hand a site off to the business and we just let them do what they want with it. And that's kind of, I think, what we're going to get into more throughout this chat this morning. But you know, making sure that the resources that we have for the infrastructure are actually being utilized to the maximum. Making sure that we don't have too much or too little. And then also from a service level perspective, making sure that the infrastructure we have is actually, we've got the right stuff we need to make sure we can deliver those service levels to the business as they require. So then I just want to just go through this definition, and Jeremy will go through, this is actually the official Microsoft definition. You can go look on the link over there and go and check it out. But essentially what they're saying is that, you know, when we ask the question, what is SharePoint governance? It says, governance is the set of policies, roles, responsibilities, and processes that guides, directs, and controls how organizations, business divisions, and IT teams cooperate to achieve business goals. Very long-winded, right? So we're gonna shorten that a little bit and give you a little bit of insight into what it is from our perspective and why we see it that way.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, with this in mind, obviously if you guys use TechNet or MSDN to look at information that's available around SharePoint and governance, although this definition is very clear in terms of the objectives, unfortunately a lot of what Microsoft provides are very technically orientated IT pro type based information. There's not a lot of information out there for the business people maybe on that governance board that's available for them to help them to be successful with SharePoint governance. So what I try and do is take the picture a little bit differently. Essentially, from within an organization, there should be corporate governance. You should, somewhere within your organization, have a set of objectives, goals, and strategies that are defined with your organization. And your CEO or your IT manager should actually have an IT governance document that aligns to that corporate governance. What is the kind of the surprise is that a lot of people talk about SharePoint governance as it's something new and unique to SharePoint. The reality is that it's essentially a system governance approach. SAP, Lotus Notes, all those other systems within your IT organization still require the same sorts of system governance that has to align to that IT governance plan and has to align to that corporate governance plan. And that's something that often is forgotten. I still see in extremely large organizations that they don't have that defined IT governance plan across all their systems. And that for me is usually a big red flag where it's not your guys' fault owning the SharePoint system, that it should be the responsibility of the IT organization as a whole, that they should set the IT governance system so that those can align to it. And then from a governance perspective, much like Mike just said, it is about those roles and responsibilities. But if we put SharePoint as a service in the middle of this cog, the first thing we have to understand is about the people. It's about the people that are using SharePoint. It's about the people that are accountable and own SharePoint. It's about the people that are actually coming up with defining those policies that get put in place of how we're going to use SharePoint and what are those expectations and boundaries of what we're going to use SharePoint for. We have a lot of organizations that have external records management systems where documents should appropriately be put in there rather than inside SharePoint. But who knows that that's the case? Where is that policy that defines those things? So it's very important that the people sit down from all over the organization and set these policies with each of the individual systems. The problem with putting all these policies in place is often what happens is it's a big lumpy document that gets put on the CIO's desk, he scribbles on it, it gets put on his bookshelf, and it gets filed away and no one actually refers to it because it's too long. So what we try and recommend is that these things should be very, very small and bite-sized, very succinct, so it's easy to reference. But the other thing that we try and help with is that it should be something you should provide a process that effectively enforces that policy. And what we say is that if you can't put a process in place that can't enforce the policy, then you should be questioning why you have that policy in the first place. I see a lot of organizations going, you shouldn't break list item security. Because why? Because there's a performance issue if you do that in a larger list, it starts to slow down your SharePoint site. That's actually quite hard to enforce, and we'll come down to that later on in terms of the controls you have over a SharePoint environment. So if you can't enforce it easily with a flick of a switch in SharePoint that says you may not break inheritance at a list item level, then it's going to be very, very hard to enforce that policy is actually being met within the organization with SharePoint's usage. So often what happens is technology comes into play here, which basically replicates a defined process to enforce that policy. And that's essentially what we're saying from a services layer within SharePoint. We're saying that the service you provide to your business is that layer between SharePoint and your business that is there to provide these processes that enforces the policies that you define. And that'll all become a little more clearer as we go through some examples of some services we can provide to the business that are put in a way that essentially shrink wraps what they can do within SharePoint to enforce those policies that you've agreed on within your organization. We all talk about proliferation of data and security management getting out of control and not knowing where things are. If we actually define those policies to keep those things constrained and in control and define processes there, we'll actually have a lot more stable environment and we'll have a lot more confidence in using SharePoint. So when we talk about this, and this doesn't build quite right, but essentially SharePoint sits in the middle. That's the service you're providing. How many people in their organizations call it SharePoint with their business? Most people, right? You don't give it a code name and try and trick people into thinking it's something else or not allow them to go searching on Bing for information on how to use SharePoint design and with their team sites they've been given. We've seen a lot more organizations now call this as a service, call it as the workload. So if you're using SharePoint as a document management system, we call it the document management system of the organization. We don't necessarily call it SharePoint. If you're using it for search, maybe you call it the search center for your organization rather than SharePoint. At the end of the day, you're providing workloads to the organization, and there's many more. Business intelligence, web content management, there's all those different things that you can provide SharePoint as a platform back to your organization. But the key is that you have to have that governance layer in there on how you should be using that service. And then the business interact via that governance layer. Now, the governance layer is really the soft stuff. It's about getting that agreement on, yes, you can use SharePoint, and yes, when you have a team site for your project, you can have 100 gig. But it's very, very hard to do that as a word of mouth thing. So what happens is there is this management layer. Come on here. There you go. There's this management layer there which essentially enforces those policies you put in place. And this is really what we're going to be talking about today is those layers of how you can do that management to enforce those governance policies you want to put in place. And we'll introduce some of the most common ones we see when we talk to customers in that environment.
Cool. So now that Jeremy's talked a little bit about the governance and different policies, etc., we want to actually ask the question of, it's great that we've got a governance committee and that in place, but how much governance is really needed? That's a really important question to ask, because if you look at from a visibility perspective, you may have intranet portals, community sites, project team sites, etc., and your My sites. The reality there is that the governance that you apply to different levels of visibility is going to be different for every type of content, every type of site that's out there. So, for example, on a portal where everyone's having access and a lot of people in and out, there's going to be a lot more control over that in comparison to something like a My site where you're going to share with your buddies and it's kind of a lot looser from a security perspective. But very important to make sure that as you apply governance, you have a look at the different layers of visibility with inside your organization. And not just about that, there may be different segments of where content sits as well, and you may want to understand how governance is going to apply to those different areas as you plan out your SharePoint strategy. The next thing about from a governance perspective is it's very important to understand who are the people that are involved here. And I think one of the things that gets left out quite often, specifically from if we look at the history of SharePoint and the way it's developed over the years, initially was under the desk server, and they just sprawled all over the place. And before you know it, it's something that's just out of control. But essentially, it came out of IT. So what's been forgotten over the years is that it's very important to make sure that all the people across the business have some visibility and involvement into your governance plans as well as your SharePoint strategy. So obviously IT, you've got your architects, these IT operations and SharePoint admins, which some of you are in the room, your business owners for intranets and departmental owners or from a functional perspective owners. And then there's obviously the back office. You want to actually have buy-in and support and ownership in each of these areas to make sure that actually you're driving value to those people. If you don't talk to those people and involve them, you're never really going to understand what their requirements are or understand how to meet their needs. But probably the most important thing, and as I talk to large corporations around the world when I'm on the road and traveling, one of the things we find, if you ask who owns SharePoint internally, a lot of people can't answer that question. So from an executive sponsorship perspective, really important that someone in your organization at a senior enough level can actually take ownership of SharePoint strategy and actually drive it with inside the business to, so that there can be good investment. But from a governance perspective, very important that all these people are involved.
Yeah, and just to add to that as well, it shouldn't be from a technology perspective they own it. It should be from a service perspective. So you may have someone that owns the document management service back to the organization that is different from the person that owns maybe the My Site social aspects of the service that SharePoint provides. Don't think that one person has to own the entire platform. That's a mistake we've seen quite a bit in extremely large organizations, because not everyone's an expert on every area of the organization in terms of how those services work. The most typical things that we see from a defining policies are these two here. So we see the infrastructure and the operational policies being defined. So we see service level agreements getting defined. What's the uptime of SharePoint? What's the recovery point objective and recovery time objectives of my content within SharePoint? What is the performance of my pages of SharePoint? What's the ROI, the return in terms of if I call help desk and getting help on a SharePoint site that I own within the business? Those are the types of things that tend to get kind of figured out within the governance side of things. The next most common thing we'll see is information architecture. When we talk about information architecture, we're really talking about how we're defining the site structure. How many site collections are there within SharePoint? How many sub-sites are we going to allow? What security we're going to apply at each level? What content types we're going to have at each level? Those things kind of get forced upon us when we start doing an intranet, or whether we start doing things like we're going to have a document management system within SharePoint. It's very, very clear to understand that there is more than those three typical policies that need defining within a governance plan. You'll often find that after the fact, you'll go, all right, we really needed to define this up front to set that expectation. And I guess the biggest one for me is really this information management one. This is the one that kind of is after the fact. And what I mean by information management is really things such as the records managers, when they jump up and down, they go, oh my God, you've got documents in here that need to be retained for 7 years for legal compliance perspectives. Or you've got PII information or personal information in there that shouldn't be in SharePoint at all, because SharePoint hasn't got the security measures that records management system over here has. People don't know that when they first start using SharePoint. It's a dumping ground. You give them contribute rights, they're going to start contributing. But if you have a policy in place inside your governance plan and your training team leverage that governance plan, you've set that expectation that way. And it's very important that you speak to your records managers up front and your legal team to understand what you should and shouldn't be doing within SharePoint. The other key thing I think is missing in a lot of organizations when they go, right, quick, flick up the lights on SharePoint, is this concept of a project management team. It's the ability to say, well, if someone comes to me and goes, I want to spin up a social workload, whose responsibility is it as a project manager to run that project? What budget's that coming out of? How are we going to track that thing? What resources are going to be involved in running it? Often IT own that, but the reality is it may be a project externally of IT. So it's important that it's defined up front how the rules of engagement are going to go when running project management on SharePoint as that platform. And then more importantly is having those leaders. Now, natural leaders will step up, and they'll be bashing their elbows around and slamming tables and making, oh, you had a meeting about SharePoint and I wasn't in it. But it's key to have leaders within the organization that not necessarily are the architects or the admins of SharePoint. Leadership should come from throughout the organization, and it should be those business owners that we talked about in the previous slide. But it also should be champions and people that are and compassionate about technology, but by basically with their ethos of pushing it through as a service to the organization. And then, obviously, for the devs, IT pro relationship in the room, and myself and Mark Rhodes are having a session at 3:30 today where we're going to go really deep into this, is this concept of defining what you can and cannot do within SharePoint. So when I talk about customizations, I'm talking about things like solution packages deployments. I'm talking about whether I'm allowed to go to a vendor and buy a solution and deploy it into that farm. Setting those expectations up front really does clear a lot of the air where there may be ambiguous things where you go for a whole process of buying a product, walk to IT and go, we need to install this in the SharePoint platform. They're going to know you're not allowed to do that. So defining those things up front is very, very important. And then one thing I think gets missed a lot is everyone kind of leaves adoption to the last minute. IT are focusing on getting SharePoint at the door, getting the lights on, getting the internet up and running, but they don't think about the change management process, the communication plans, and the training that needs to be done to get that adoption up onto SharePoint. So what I say from an adoption perspective is to define what is the standard approach that if you release a new service from SharePoint to your organization, what are the adoption things you're going to do as a minimum? So that when the project managers are defining, okay, we're releasing social into our organization, here are the adoption things we're going to do. You are going to need a communication plan that's going to cost this much money. You are going to have to get training involved, and you are going to get all these other bits and pieces in line as well. So defining those things up front saves a lot of time later on when people go, oh, we went to TechNet and or TechEd, and we saw that you know the PowerView stuff's really cool in the BI. We want to start using BI within SharePoint. Having those things defined clears a lot of that muddy waters that happens where IT suddenly become the bad guy and that business unit over there install their own SharePoint farm and go, sod IT, we're going to do it ourselves. So defining those up front and that having the business own that's very, very important.
If I can just add to that as well, Jeremy, in my chats with a lot of organizations, what I see a lot of is, and specifically in organizations where, the, you know, it, probably in construction or those types of energy companies, you see a lot of organizations like that generally the business has a good concept of what they think should happen, but that doesn't get executed and flowed into the field where the actual users are using the platform and making sure they've got the training that they need to ensure that adoption happens. So you find a lot of disconnect between the business and actual IT. IT's wanting to do all of these things and train the users, but what ends up happening, and I'm talking big organizations that have some very, very significant investment in SharePoint, I'd be surprised what sort of level of training they give their staff to actually make sure that they can equip them to do their jobs better using SharePoint.
Yeah. And then the last one is effectively this concept of continuous improvement. So with any system that you define, if you're defining policies and you're defining processes to enforce those policies, you need to be thinking about how you can improve that process. So sometimes what we find with organizations is last year they go through a whole exercise of building out this governance plan with all these policies, and they find that maybe some of those policies were a little bit too ambitious, or maybe they're a little bit over the top. So they have measures in place every quarter, every 6 months, to see whether those policies have been effective, whether they have been enforceable, and maybe sometimes they dial them back a little bit, or in some cases, maybe they realize they haven't been effective enough, so they put more stringent policies and processes in place. So that's very, very important from that perspective. So with that kind of setting the scene there of having that governance model, what we're seeing in the marketplace now is that typically you start by trying to do these things manually. So you've defined this policy document of SLAs and security models and information architecture and all these other bits and pieces we've talked about. And a lot of the time it's encouragement. So we encourage you to read this document. And I know you're not going to read it, but we encourage you to read it and hopefully you'll follow and abide our rules. In reality, we know that people aren't going to read those things. And there's lots of examples of that we see out there. And we know that manually going in and checking that people are doing the right things is also very, very resource intensive. So some of the larger organizations that we work with have started to do what I'm kind of terming the semi-automated approach, which is they'll have some PowerShell scripts, or they'll have some command line apps, or some WYSIWYG things on the SQL database, which you really shouldn't be doing, that will basically check, okay, well, if a policy was you can't have list item security broken, we can do a PowerShell script that goes for every web app, for every site collection, for every site, for every list, check whether those items on an SP query have those broken security permissions. Okay, it's going to be time consuming. You probably don't want to run that every day. You definitely want to be running that every hour. But it's something that you could run to see whether you're enforcing your policies. And maybe you produce a report that can go to someone to then run around and tell people, look, you've broken security on a document level. Again, not that effective. It's still going to have those issues. That's just one example of that. There's plenty of other examples of those kind of things. There are also third-party products at that semi-automated perspective that will produce you a report that shows you where you're incompliant, depending on what country you're from, to those policies that you've defined. But what we're seeing more and more now is this concept of a fully automated process that basically enforces each of those policies. Now, those can be very time-consuming. And what we're finding is that different dev teams are being asked to build these processes within their organization. So one might be built in ASP.NET, another might be an HTML5 JavaScript app, one might be a PowerShell thing with an InfoPath front end on it. And what that happens over time is that as they realize that they need 30 processes for maybe 60 policies that they've agreed on within their organization, those 30 policies processes have their own individual application life cycles. And it's costing the organization money to actually maintain and operate those processes that they've got in place. So a lot of the pressure is put on Microsoft to make sure that they're making SharePoint more manageable so they don't need those processes. So when I'm at the TAP events in Redmond with the product group and they go, what would you like to see? A lot of the time it's like, well, give us a tick box that goes, we're not going to allow list item broken security in list. How useful would that be? It can't be that hard to add that. It's still not in 2013. But it's those kind of examples where they're looking at Microsoft and then they're looking at vendors because they don't want to have internal apps. I have a lot of discussions with people. They go, surely, Jeremy, we're not the only ones building a site provisioning tool inside InfoPath or inside a custom list with a SharePoint designer workflow. Why haven't you guys built something as a vendor? So those kind of common things we're seeing. So what's happening now is you're seeing the vendor market build out third-party products that provide those kind of processes. So what we see now is that people try and do these things by just ticking off individual boxes within SharePoint. So this is part of the presentation is that myself and Dan Holm, who's also a fellow MVP, have written. So essentially, when we talk about controls and scopes within SharePoint, these are the common things you'll see. And any good SharePoint architect or IT pro will be able to rattle off that hierarchy, right? We think in terms of files, we think in terms of web apps, site collections, and sites. And we have this kind of concept of a content database that multiple site collections can sit in. But the key here is that typical things that we see are things like security being managed within a subsite of SharePoint. That's an element of a management and control that's been put in place. And obviously, security can go at a site collection level. We can even do it with web application policies at web app level. We also see things like being able to block file types. So maybe we're not going to allow CAD diagrams or Adobe Photoshop PSD files being allowed within that particular web application. But the problem is with these management controls, where security could be applied at every single layer in this scope, that block file type can only be done via the web config change at the web application layer. So our management controls really kind of affect how we can architect our SharePoint platform to provide it as a service to enforce those policies we have in place. And this often trips up a lot of people. Now, there are other management controls, such as things like data storage SLAs, identifying the service applications that are in play can only be done at that farm level, what features are activated, whether we're using enterprise features or standard features, and things like who are the full control site collection admins of a site. If we've got 50,000 sites within a site collection and we give someone site collection admin rights to that site collection, they've got God mode on all those sites. Maybe that isn't necessarily a good thing. So having those management controls, you have to really understand kind of what you're doing when you do this. So typically, as a traditional approach, what we see is people start here. They start with this concept of, we have team sites, okay? That's going to go in its own web application, teams.avpoint.com. We had our my sites, or our people area, people service, which would be my.avpoint.com. And then we have our intranet, which might be intranet.avpoint.com. Each of those is separate web applications, so by nature, each is going to have its own associated content database typically, and it will have its own associated site collections and sites within it. So we can start to say that, well, we know that our GIS team is going to be using CAD diagrams, so we can unblock the CAD diagrams in our team site, but for our people on our intranet, we'll still block those files. So therefore, we've enforced that policy that's been in place within our organization by those management scopes. But what we see now is things like, well, as new teams come on board in that team service, we'll do it as a separate site collection. We'll give them a separate content database. Why? because we can apply more granular quotas and keep a better look and SLAs if we start to split these things up. Now, back in 2007 days, a lot of people just have one giant site collection and lots of sites. Then Microsoft put out all the TechNet guidance from a technical perspective around the sizing of content databases. You should really be focusing on having lots and lots of site collections. Do not be scared about multiple site collections. I was talking with a customer this morning. He had 50,000 site collections. Every single team project was his own site collection, which meant that if one got very, very huge, he could go and push that into his own content database. The content database might be running on a separate SQL farm that's got a lot higher performance to provide better, provide better SLAs. But then what we also see is the addition of new farms. Now, this might start to scare people, but just, you know, bear with me while I talk through this. But essentially, it's this concept of we need an extranet. Now, traditionally, you would have probably spun that up inside your internal farm, given them Active Directory user accounts and been, you know, had to fight that battle with AD and then, you know, poke it through the firewall. And what we're seeing now, though, is that the extranets have been spun up in Office 365. They're being spun up in Azure IaaS VMs, or they're being spun up in a Rackspace or a FP web type environment in the cloud. And maybe or maybe not, they may have a link back into the internal data. To have that link back, what you'll probably see is that we'll provide a shared services farm. So we'll create a search, a user profile, managed metadata, and a business connected services perspective to connect and share between those two environments. Now, obviously, there are some limitations with BCS, but that's what we're really seeing at the moment. If we want to share managed metadata, we can start connecting these things. And then additionally from that, what we start to see is business units going, look, this is too slow for us. We're willing to throw down a load of money so we can have a higher performing SLA farm. So what you'll start to see is this concept of asterisks or power farms, where maybe finance are saying, we need a better SLA on backup and recovery and disaster recovery, and in terms of page performance, here's a load of money, go build me a super, super fast farm, Mr. IT person, so that this business service can meet the demands of that particular department. So you can see here that if later down the track HR got wind that finance have got a faster farm, we can now move HR over into that higher business critical farm in a lot easier way. So really think about how you're architecting your farm at that technical perspective. But the key is this is to provide and enforce those policies from a services perspective within your organization. And then the next thing you'll kind of see is this concept of building applications. Now, I have worked with a lot of organizations in Australia where their applications, they custom applications they build, whether it's InfoPath forms, whether it's complicated workflows, whether it's we've got 20 different document libraries with different content types and we've got workflow on each and business processes being run in it that sit within a site collection, within a subsite, within a subsite. And then we try and upgrade from 2007 to 2010 and there's this damn customization that's sitting within our site collection that we can't upgrade that site. So what we tend to recommend is that you start thinking about isolating your applications. So in these areas here, these are very true vanilla SharePoint sites. These things are just out-of-the-box stuff with a few features enabled, maybe some controlled branding via a solution package that's been deployed. But if you're going to start going full hog, source control, automated builds, automated deployments, those kind of things, you should really be treating those things as true line-of-business apps and therefore isolate those things. And then essentially with that, you get the miniature apps. So when I talk about line-of-business apps, I'm talking about maybe I've built a project management system within SharePoint, or maybe I've even used Project Server. Or maybe I've built a whole expense claim system within SharePoint that works with SAP and SharePoint's that front end. Isolate those things. But even those small apps, maybe it's just an InfoPath form, give it its own site collection and put it there. It's not going to make a big deal to the user. They have to go to a different URL to access that system. But at least that way you've got that isolation. What that means is when people go, I want to move to 2013 of SharePoint, you can go, no problem, guys. We can upgrade this on-premises farm here in a snap because we haven't customized it. And then we can leave these other customized farms to after the fact and do an assessment there from that perspective. I do cover that in a bit more with Mark's session later on. But it's very, very key to understand that kind of separation of management controls and the logical model of SharePoint to reach those kind of service levels that you need. But please don't be scared. You saw four or five farms on that screen. You don't necessarily have to do that. And even this services farm can be as part of that on-premise farm. You know, they don't recommend more than 10 web locations in a farm, but at least that gives you that separation of concerns there. So please don't think you have to just go with one web application. Please don't do just one site collection and thousands of sub-sites. Really think about leveraging that logical model. Now, granted, there are some things that will make life a little bit trickier, like navigation. As soon as you spit out site collections, you lose the ability to kind of manage navigation. Guess what? Excuse me. They fixed that in SharePoint 2013 with a search capability, which is good. They fixed the content type problem in 2010 with a content type hub. They still necessarily haven't fixed the SharePoint group security problem, but you can use Active Directory groups to cross site collections as a way around that. They're the key three ones that kind of trip you up when you start splitting things into site collections that may be in multiple different places. So just kind of bear that in mind if you're in the process of looking at introducing another workload into SharePoint. Think about where you're putting those things. And there is some guidance on this on TechNet, but it doesn't really kind of tell the story from that upgradability and portability perspective as well. So with that, we're going to just talk about some services here. And Garth's going to talk about the first one. Before I jump into it, though, essentially what I wanted to say was, as SharePoint grows, which it does do, you might introduce it just with my sites and think, oh, people aren't going to use this, but people like the people search. And then they've got all their team sites in their my sites, so you have to spin up a team site environment. And suddenly you're a SharePoint admin that thought it was a good idea that you introduce SharePoint into your organization, and all of a sudden now you're a bottleneck to the organization and what you're doing. So with that perspective, you'll get a lot of unstructured requests. Much this, I'm not talking any different from any other system within your organization. But the key here is that it's very, very hard to measure how busy you are as a person, which therefore means that if you're the bottleneck and you want to get investment for new bodies, it's very, very hard for you to do that. So by identifying those common, what I say, services that you're requested to do, we can actually start measuring that and measuring your value and measuring the capability of either introducing a technology to save you time or to go and buy more bodies to come in and help you run SharePoint within your organization. So we've identified, I think, 9 today that we're going to quickly go through, and then we're going to talk about this concept of how we get the measuring that return on investment. So a typical service is essentially that a user comes in, and my buttons aren't working, a user comes in, and he's basically going to give you a bunch of information about something. And I won't steal Garth's thunder. And then typically, it will go for an approval process. So I want a new person to be added to my group. Okay, then who's going to approve that person should be available in that site? And then what happens is, sorry, I jumped it. What happens is that then something, whether you as a manual administrator or where maybe as a PowerShell script that you've cleverly written or whether you're using a product, will go and do whatever that person's asked. I'm teaching people to suck eggs a little bit, but I just wanted to kind of put that at a very high level. This is what we're defining as a service within there. So Garth's just going to talk about a few services that we typically see within organizations, and then I'll jump in and talk about a few as well.
Cool. Thanks, Jeremy. So the first thing we're going to look at is site collection and site provisioning. And typically, it's probably the most common reason for giving contribute to end users. And I think that's probably kind of one of the things we see as being quite a high risk, is you put that control into the hands of the user, and they get the ability to actually just stand up these sites as you go. So as a service, it's really important to have a mechanism in place, and Jeremy talked about that process flow from a site collection, site provisioning perspective. And just remember, we talked about the manual, the semi-automated, and the automated. Take those into consideration as well. But I think this is probably the one thing that we see in organizations, particularly a lot bigger ones, that Jeremy talked about, a customer with 50,000 sites. Very important to have these types of processes in place so you can actually track that and provide a good service to be able to get those sites out and actually manage them correctly. And then, of course, from a request perspective, it's important to have a process in place so that you can actually delegate someone to take care of these requests as they come in. An important part about that as well is also tracing the requesting of access. If you think about from a request perspective, that can come in so many different formats. It can be a phone call that comes into the help desk. It can be an email. It can be several different forms that may come in. Important to understand what all of those are and put in a process for each one of those to make sure that you're following a good process to offering a service from a site collection and site provisioning perspective. Then we're going to look at some profiles and plans for semi-automated governance. You can see here we've got four different categories. So you've obviously got different types of backup, different types of storage, archiving, and auditing. Very important to understand, and we talked about the visibility into different types of sites that you may have out there, sites which may be my sites or even portals that you got out there. Those are going to need different levels of SLAs, and those are the four areas that we feel are really important to consider from a service level perspective. You know, from a backup perspective, you may have a site that, you know, doesn't even get touched every 6 months, so you wouldn't actually back that up every day. You'd probably back that up, you know, not even every week. But certainly having different layers of storage and layers of archiving and auditing and backup that you can offer to the business as a service, depending on what the business requirements are. So you look at end-to-end policy interface and some examples of the SLAs that are out there. We break that up into three areas. And this is quite a common model. You've got gold, silver, and bronze. But you can see we've got that broken down into an operational function. And you've got, for each standard, you've got different levels of service that you're going to offer to the business. Jeremy will talk a little bit how we segment that and make a bit more sense when it comes to in the actual business. But there's also additional SharePoint things that you can add to those levels of service. You know, from a SharePoint designer perspective, you may want gold level to be enabled for SharePoint designer, but on the bronze level and the silver level, you don't want them to have access to that. And then, of course, there's the content database, which is quite important. You can either have an isolated content database or shared. You can have different layers of storage and different costs of storage. A lot of the things that come into consideration when offering SharePoint as a service is also chargeback. So that's one thing you've got to remember, is that when you're handing off and having these processes in place, really important to be able to. Some businesses don't care about cost. They're like, we'll just pay for it, it's fine. Other businesses want to be able to track, and as they offer that back to the business as a service, be able to say, you know what, if you go for a gold level site, it's going to cost you X amount per month, or if you go for a silver, it's going to, and there may be different business units that Jeremy will talk about, but they all have different needs when it comes to these types of things as well.
Yeah, and just to add to that as well, this is probably the most common one that we see. We had a lot of customers using the gold, silver, bronze. I've worked with one customer that had 10 tiers, which, to be honest, got very confusing. The business unit was like, well, which one do I pick? The gold, silver, bronze is probably the easiest three to kind of pick out. The key really that we see with the financial businesses I work with in New York is that it's the auditing aspect and the archiving of the content. So how long are we having to retain that data? Maybe if it's a very, very high profile customer, or maybe because they're a regulated user within their organization, they do need to have that 7-year retention of data, and we do need to audit absolutely everything. Whereas if it's a team site for the local office's basketball team that go out and get drunk after the game and drink a few beers and take photos and want somewhere to put them, then that really doesn't need a gold level of service within SharePoint. That can have a lot cheaper bronze service. So that's the way that we see a lot of organizations working now. The business critical staff needs that rigor in place, whereas the less business critical staff goes into that bronze circuit.
And I think most organizations that we talk to, there is no concept of this. It's just kind of, here's SharePoint and here are all our sites, and there's actually no really real definition between even a my site and a portal or a team site or those sort of things. So very important, I think, from a service level perspective, to actually segment different types of service to the business.
Yeah. And what we see there is that we're seeing two very big organizations we're working with where they've built their own custom system, is that they provide HR with a mechanism to create an employee site for every employee that they manage all the employees' details within. And that has to be a gold-policed site because of the nature of the sensitivity of that data. And they're even doing things like having a 3-stage approval process before that employee site gets created within their environment. And what's really, really important is that they actually capture the business contact for that employee site. That's very different than me just giving someone site collection admin rights. Because when I give someone site collection admin rights, that's giving them god mode to that site collection, which means they can do a lot of things in that SharePoint environment they shouldn't be doing. The majority of the time when you give someone site collection admin, it's just to prove who's accountable for that site. But by doing that, you're giving them God mode, and you're probably not giving them training on how to use it. So often they'll break things. So what we're seeing now is that people are providing mechanisms for storing who is accountable for that site collection, but they don't want to use site collection admin or don't want to drop them in the site owner's group. So a lot of people are using manual spreadsheets to keep a record that maybe we've lost your site collection because the content database is corrupt. We want to contact the accountable person. Typically, at the minute, you guys would just notify the primary or the secondary site collection admins. But the danger there is you're giving them too many elevated rights. And then maybe you have a small projects division that are spinning up new site collections for every small project. That may only require a bronze type policy because they're not business critical sites. And they also might be classifying those site collections by the project sizes or the customer that project is relevant to. So it's like metadata are capturing at that site collection level that is typically stored maybe in the property bag of the site and displayed as part of the page layer on that page. And then also like maybe the sales team, they're creating customer sites for every customer they work with. They might be able to choose between a gold or a silver package depending on how they want to work, so they understand what that package is going to do. And they might say that maybe it's a small business or a medium-sized business or an enterprise customer account. So from a governance system perspective, I can list all of my site collections, I can see who is the business contact, and I can see how that site collection is classified. Now again, that leads back to, we can start doing chargeback based on that. Maybe we capture the employee department down here for the HR employee sites, and we charge the departments to manage their employee information site collections. And this is what we're seeing with this financial institution in New York. They're going to this degree of classifying their content. The biggest thing I have a problem with is if I go into SharePoint and I go to a team site that I've discovered via search, and there's some content in there that's really, really out of date, and you look at the version history of the document, and you see the last modified person, and they were just doing an edit. Maybe they were updating the branding on the document, and they haven't kept the versions of the document. How do I know who to go to, who's accountable for that content to get it back up to date again? So having a business contact at the site level gives me a starting point. Oh, okay, I need to go and speak to Garth, and he can tell me that. So that business contact is very, very important from the accountability aspect. And then the next thing we're seeing is not obviously that bar sitting there like that. That's a sneaky one that's sneaked in there. Is this concept of the life cycle of a site. Now, this is very, very important. A lot of people talk about storage growth of SharePoint and their concerns. The concept here is that a site does get created. We're seeing a lot of organizations now having this concept of a lease, where you ask for a site, your site's going to last for a year. And after a year, I'm going to reach back out to you and ask if you actually want to use it anymore. And they might go, yep, we're going to renew this. We want to renew the lease because we're still using it. And then further down the line, maybe they go, actually, we've had it for 2 years now. Yes, you're right. We're actually going to, we don't need that anymore, so you can delete it. But we don't just delete the site. We had the customer's program actually archive that site and locked it before it completely deleted it from the SharePoint environment. But we know users lie. They're going to click in, yep, we want to renew this lease, we want to renew this lease. So we actually had one customer we were talking to where they actually had an inactivity trigger. So if no one was viewing the content within that site or that site collection, it triggered. Guess what? No one's even accessed your content for the last 6 months. So you've got to decide now, and it will be audited, whether you actually want to keep this site or whether you're ready to delete it. So what that means from a site collection growth perspective on storage is rather than it just exponentially going up, it starts to see a bit of a more mature, normalized pattern coming through. And obviously different things happen along the life cycle of the document, whether it's maybe the business contact changes, whether it's the policy changes. We asked for a gold site, but now we've decided we don't want to pay for a gold site, we only want to pay for a silver site. So that ability to change the policy. And also the classification or the purpose of the site. So if it was a small project, maybe we want to change the purpose of the classification. And some wonderful users will actually proactively go, actually this project's finished now, so how do I delete the site collection? Well, we need to provide a mechanism for them to request that the site be deleted or maybe archived depending on the policy of that site collection. So this is something that we see very, very clearly coming up in a lot of organizations now. And 2013 has actually introduced this concept of a lease expiration. within Sites with a very rudimentary workflow, but it is actually there within 2013. So Microsoft have seen this pattern happening as well as we are as we go out and speak to those large customers. So with that, I'm going to spin. Oh no, actually, I'm doing this one as well.
Yeah.
So this was another common one we saw, and this was more for financial institutions. This was this concept of I own a site, and I have to recertify it because I have to understand that there's content in this site that I'm accountable for. That maybe from that perspective, or there's a lot of storage growth, or I have to go for a security audit and see who has access to my site. So I have to look through the document, and go, oh, look, there's John. Why has John got access to this site? And maybe we have a wedding, or maybe we have a digital signature that I have to sign to say, yes, I am recertifying that all this information I'm signing up for, whether it's the users, to do with the content, to do with the security access or the storage growth, I'm signing up for that and saying, I am happy with this site collection. And again, it's audited. So that's covering the IT people who are running and keeping the lights on, but it's making the accountability on the business owners who are accountable for that content. And this is definitely coming up in financial institutions. We're actually seeing it more now, and we tend to find this pattern happens, but in government organizations, this recertification process is happening on content areas. And it doesn't have to be site collections. It can be sites as well, depending on how you architect your farm. But we're certainly seeing this tick in the box that, yes, I'm happy that this security mapping is correct.
Cool. Number four is about granting and removing permissions. And I think, once again, you know, one of the reasons for needing more than contribute. But if we have to look at, you know, I want to just go down a bit here. Delegation of requests again and traceability of access requests. Now, I didn't touch on this on the previous slide, but one of the things that's important to remember in these processes, that's just not about being able to know who did what and who requested what, but it's actually from a compliance perspective, a lot of the time you need to actually be able to show these things as they came in and be able to track them and report on them as well. But from a granting and removing permissions perspective, having a mechanism in place where that can be done automatically and potentially an email would be, you know, access is given to a site, and an automated email goes out to that user saying, you have now been granted access, and then with a link to that site as well, which is really important. And number six is transferring and cloning permissions. You know, one of the things that might happen is, you know, you may have a team where a new user joins and you want to give them access. A way of doing that without having to log a service request. User may change roles. That happens a lot. People change jobs all the time, you know. Having a way, one of the things that I see a lot from a security perspective is that a user will join in one role and they'll, 6 months later they go to another department, and before you know it, they've carried their permissions all around where they've gone with them. There's no real way of reporting on that and making sure that when a user changes roles, their actual permissions change as well. And potentially you may have someone replacing that user, so you're going to put, make sure you can clone those the permissions that user has and apply that to the new user. And then you've got situations where there are complex security models. So, intranet, extranet, you may have some external contractors that are working. You want to have a way of automating requests for different areas and transferring permissions based on what their roles are. And again, delegating of requests and tracing the requesting access that comes in, being able to report on those as well. And then content move, obviously out of the box, when you do moves via File Explorer, you're definitely losing data integrity, and you've got to remember that. So having a way to relocate content based on workloads. So, you may have areas, in your My Site, and you want to now move your My Site content to a different location, but your team sites, and you may have content that's moving around all the time. We've got customers that have offices all over the place with different farms. How do we say a project moves from London to New York? How do you actually make sure that content gets shifted across? And from a service perspective, how do you actually automate that? And then you have, believe it or not, we have customers that are moving off cloud to on-premise. You know, it happens depending on what the business need is. And restructuring sites from an architectural perspective. I mean, taxonomies are things that change all the time based on business decisions that get made. You know, restructures with inside the business cause you to rethink what your taxonomy is going to look like. How do we put mechanisms in place to make sure that's a little more automated and a great service can be added to the business there as well? And from an architecture perspective, Jeremy talked about that earlier, when you have different farms segmented and when you're doing migrations, those things, if you make those architectural decisions, good decisions early on, it makes that move a lot easier. Then from a content recovery perspective, you know, users delete files all the time. So how do you have a mechanism in place where you know, the speed of restoring that content is actually a lot quicker and automated? The user can go in potentially and restore that file himself without having to actually come to IT, log a request, you know, wait for a database to be mounted, etc. Having mechanisms to granularly restore content and giving that service to the user in a more automated way.
Yeah, I think I'm sorry. And then the other thing is, and it's just all of these things are very common because organizations don't want to give people site collection admin rights. They just want to give them contribute rights, or sometimes they'll give them site owner rights to give them full control. We're seeing a lot of organizations now going, no, 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 we just want them to be able to add, edit, and delete content within those areas. We don't want them to be able to go into site settings or site collection settings as well. So by doing that, what happens is some things get taken away from them. And the best example of this is a lot of the reports. You have to be a site collection admin to see some of those reports around analytics and different things. And so what we see a lot of people now doing is building workarounds to be able to produce those reports for those accountable owners, but without giving them site collection rights. There is no tick box that says give someone rights to reports without giving them God mode across that entire site collection. So by having the facility of providing this in a service way gets around that issue. And this is a lot of the reasons that we're driving the move content and the transfer of mission aspects. So things that we see a lot being requested are things like top users, what's the top content, who has access. So if I point to this site, who has access to this site and why? So how comes John has access to this site? I can't work it out. Oh, okay, well, John's in this Active Directory group, and this AD group's been applied to this AD group, and this AD group is in this site with full control. So having those kind of who has access reports are very important. But it can also spin the other way around. What does Garth have access to? That is an important report as well. Maybe their managers have to sign off on those kind of things. So those kind of reports are the ones we see as most common. One that's not so common, but it's more IT related, but some business owners, especially if they're being charged for the storage they're using, want to be able to see the storage growth of their site. So we need to be able to provide a mechanism to provide those reports. And obviously, you know, there's various ways that you can do that with development approaches. So with the last one, and we are a little bit short, so I'm going to jump through these bits and let Garth jump through his, is essentially the reason that we want to measure and apply return on investment is because we want to show the value of SharePoint back to the organization. I think a lot of the times IT just see it as, we've got an eCal and we've got SharePoint and it doesn't matter about proving its worth. The problem that we're seeing now is that other alternatives are coming up and they're losing out and they're being questioned and versus against from that perspective. So essentially what we're saying is that you need to highlight the issues in adoption and ROI at the beginning. So when we talked about defining that adoption level, when you're defining your policies, think about how you're going to measure the return on investment. Think about those things you can do to track and record over time and then reflect and see, look, we've done better than we did here because of these things we're measuring. And what that does is it proves that investment. It proves that if you have this many people running SharePoint and you're spending this much a year on SharePoint and these are the returns of the business, understand that. And that's what you need to give back to those very high-level champions to prove the worth of it. And from there, what it hopefully means is you guarantee the same investments next year, but hopefully, more importantly, you'll get more investment to do more things on SharePoint in subsequent years. A lot of people forget about this. They focus on keeping the lights on, and they don't understand that you do need to prove how SharePoint's being seen within that organization. So one of the common ones is storage growth. This is a measure that gets used, and Garth's just going to quickly highlight a few things here.
So measuring success, we talked about it earlier, and this is actually a very important one, because what tends to happen is you as an organization to your leaders will say, well, you know, look, year zero, we started off and this is how much content we had, and you know, year three or whatever, we're now sitting with 20 terabytes of content. We've had massive adoption. That is great success. But the problem with that is that you don't actually segment that content, because we've got customers with 5 terabytes in SharePoint. It's actually just a content dump for them. So very important to segment. You can see here the red is actually inactive content. You've got a massive growth of content in SharePoint. Half of it's not even being touched. Actually, probably 80% of it's not being touched. So in order to drive good value and help the business understand where the success is, you not only need to segment around what the actual active content growth is, but you actually, it's important to show, you know what, year one, we had 1 terabyte, year two, we had 20. This percentage is active, this is inactive. But not only that, year zero, we only used it for content, then we went to collaboration, then we did development, and now we full ECM on SharePoint. And we've got a great adoption on users. So try to be a little more granular about how you present your content use to the business. And there's a very strong cost attached to this red piece that the business is going to care about. So you want to actually try and put in those archiving mechanisms to make sure that you can actually clean out the content that's not actually being used. We're very good at getting content into SharePoint. A lot of migration projects we're seeing happening, terabytes and terabytes going into SharePoint. We're very bad at getting rid of content in SharePoint, the content that's not needed. So looking to be a bit more granular, like I talk about, look at a way of, you know, the data size and composition is very important. Don't just understand, hey, we have 20 terabytes. Understand what the segments of that content is. For example, you can't see it. It's a little invisible there. But you may have a whole lot of the big chunk in the red there may be MP3s. I mean, that's not potentially valuable to the business. You know, you've got XLS files, documents, PDFs, etc., etc., etc. Segment that content, not only segment it, but understand what that growth looks like across the different types of content, because that'll show you where the most value and where the most usage is as well. Can I move on?
Yeah, and I guess what we're seeing more is that people are moving away from just looking at the size of the content databases and looking at the size of the site collections, and excuse these wonderful diagrams, but my daughter's trying out OneNote a little bit. But essentially what we're seeing now is that people start measuring on the number of sites and site collections. So you can see, obviously, IT are traditionally the ones that are going to be using the most because they're the ones that first adopt SharePoint. But what you'll see is that there will be sporadic growth here on different things. But again, as Garth said, that content might not be accurate. And when we think about the site collection lifecycle, we should see that in some of these cases, it'll actually fluctuate and dip as you're archiving off those site collections that are no longer used and no longer active. So it's really about thinking about the end of the life cycle as well.
Can I just, before you move on, I just want to say one thing about the previous. In terms of cost, this is really important. To be able to report on these things to the business is absolutely critical towards your SharePoint success internally. You can see there you've got sales, HR, engineering, training, etc. There's a cost attached to that. The business may say, hold on a second, we've invested X amount of money in sales and they don't even touch their sites. Why are we even bothering doing that? That's very important.
Yeah, and then the other thing that comes up is it's not just about the storage growth, or it's not about the counts of sites. It's also about the activity. And you can get logs, you can flick on auditing, no problem whatsoever. This information is really important as well. If we see that IT are consistently consuming SharePoint, and that maybe training have dips based on the fact that they have quarterly training updates, and maybe the engineering did start to use it, but then over a period of months decided they weren't going to use it anymore, that information is very, very useful to understand how SharePoint is being consumed as a service. So please don't look at that as it's just stats, who's interested in that. You can get a lot out of that picture in terms of how SharePoint's being adopted. And if you show your training department, well, look, you know, over this time, you've actually been using SharePoint quite a bit, and the company's been using it. It proves that SharePoint is being used.
And it also, I think, it'll encourage you to ask some interesting questions. I mean, you may be able to say, you know, I mean, on the previous slide was the same. Sales is, they're just not using it. We need to talk to them and understand, are we doing something wrong? Are we not giving them what they need in order to succeed on SharePoint? Why are they not using it as much as they are? Or on engineering, why did they go up to this level and they had massive use and all of a sudden it's tapering off? What can we do to maintain that level of service?
And then lastly, the other thing is that often SharePoint gets introduced to actually decommission certain system as well. Now, obviously for the Exchange people in the room, the FileShare people in the room, that might upset them. But the reality is, the amount of times that we hear is that, well, we're trying to get rid of our FileShare, we want to start using SharePoint, or we're sick of seeing attachments in Exchange, and we want to make sure that people are sending hyperlinks and emails, etc. You can measure those things as well. We can start measuring the storage growth of Exchange versus SharePoint versus FileShares to kind of prove this is the success we're having in this initiative that's been decided within the organization. Now, these are actually very easy things to pull out of those different systems, but you don't really see that often. But it's very, very important that you understand that this is a way of justifying those budgets that you have within your organization to reach those initiatives. You shouldn't just assume, well, you know, people are using SharePoint, so there must be a downfall. Speak to those other teams within your organization and present this kind of stuff to, as an IT organization to prove what your service is providing. Now, there are also qualitative things as well. So it's not just about measuring numbers. We can also go out there and produce satisfaction surveys for people to fill out about how satisfied they are with SharePoint. We can store praise emails, like even if it's like a support call that went really well, capture those stories and capture the success stories as well. Whether it's a business unit that started using SharePoint to throw away an Exchange file or a custom access database and just using SharePoint lists and workflows now, keep those stories because that again is a way of proving how successful SharePoint is within your organization. Often these things are forgotten about and then at the last minute you're fighting with IT to keep SharePoint as a system within your organization. So it's very important to think about those stories as well. Now, lastly, before we go to questions, essentially it's not just about justifying the costs. It's how we can save as well. So although we're spending all this money, we can justify it with ROI measures and reports, we also need to be able to understand about how we can save costs as we go through. So Gar's going to quickly go through this, and then we'll jump to questions.
So one of the most obvious places to look when saving costs, and we do these ROI studies with, I don't like ROI. Anyone like ROI? I'm not a big fan of it. Anyone? Okay. So one of the biggest problems with ROI is that it's actually pretty fuzzy. You know, it's very difficult to really, you can go to the business and say, oh, we did this ROI study and it's great. But you've got to look at the real places where you can actually give black and white figures. And this is one of the areas where you can look to save. And I think the cost element around SharePoint is really, a lot of it is driven around storage and where you're putting your money. But I think what a lot of people don't really understand is the difference between the different layers of storage and what the costs are associated is actually very, very significant. So if you're renting your storage, you're paying double. Most 90% of the time organizations have their content in SQL, and SQL is stored in the most high-performing and available storage that you can probably buy. But remember that graph I showed you? 80% of that content is probably not touched most of the time. So there are mechanisms to help you strategize around where you put your content and how you can, you know, drive real hard black and white ROI numbers to the business. Because you know what? If I take 1 terabyte out of here and I put it into there or into the cloud based on what its usage is or based on what the size of the content is and how it's performing, I can actually save the business a lot of money. And then I can go and justify, say, hey, well, I've just saved that money. I want to put some more money into this area or whatever the case may be. So obviously, there's the concepts of RBS and shredded storage. Shredded storage is more relevant to SharePoint 2013. I'll tell you what that is. But a lot of you, I don't know if you know what RBS is. Essentially, Microsoft's provided APIs to be able to use third-party providers to segment your content out of SQL based on its file size, based on its author, based on very many different types of things. You can actually extract that content transparent to the user out of SQL and put it in cheaper form of storage. From a presentation layer perspective, the users don't know any difference. The difference is you're putting content in a cheaper form and black and white ROI back to the business. It's really, really a good story. From a shared storage perspective, really cool feature coming in SharePoint 2013 where I may be working on a document. I've seen customers that have 1,700 versions of a document. I mean, that's 1,700 documents stored in SQL. So basically what shredded storage will do is if I'm working on a document and I complete it and I save it and I put it in SharePoint, tomorrow Jeremy opens it up and he makes some changes. When he clicks save, it doesn't actually physically save an entire copy of that document. It saves the deltas between my version and his version. So you're already looking at improved storage there, but most certainly the mechanisms for RBS are still in play because you've obviously got that ability to save based on when content's accessed, etc. So a lot to think about on the storage side, how you can save and how you can offer a better service at a better price to the business. And then just a real world scenario. It's actually local, John Holland in Melbourne. They came to us very new on SharePoint and looking to run a project, and they said we have 44 terabytes of content. I mean, that's insane. We don't see that very often. And a lot of them are, you know, bigger than 2 gig in size. They've got very deep file structures. So their character strings are exceeding what the limits are. And very, very complex permission structures. They do a lot of permissioning at the document level, which, as you know, in SharePoint is really, really not scalable. It's all done at the folder level. So you can come talk to us afterwards about this particular one, but it's very interesting how they went about taking their 44 terabytes of file share content and actually absorbing that into SharePoint.
Cool. Thanks, Garth. So just to wrap things up, essentially, you know, all these things we've talked about today is really about whether you have that success or value within providing SharePoint from an IT perspective as that service. And what I would say is that really you need to, as a call to action, understand what those policies are, identify the experts to build those policies, and set the expectations of those policies within your organization. Set those things now. If you haven't done it yet, or if you've got some policies, please invest that time in doing that, because it will save a lot of ambiguity down the path. Once you have that, maybe you need to identify those common services that you're seeing. Whether it is that you have, or we have with customers that have a full-time guy that all he does is create sites and manage security. Maybe you need to provide a way of semi-automating that process and invest in that technology, or maybe a fully automated process to do that as well. And then provide that process to your organization. And then from an optimization perspective, you'll increase as you go forward improving those processes, but more importantly, you'll be able to report on those things and be able to provide that return on investment to your organization. So with that, hopefully you've got a good understanding about what we've stepped through in this story today. As we wrap up, there are some other sessions. Most of the sessions are already gone, actually. This one on 2013 is Friday at 11:30. For those that aren't too hungover from the party tonight, at 8:15, there's a really good one which is on Office 365. That's actually Fortescue Metal, which is a Perth-based customer that will be providing a case study on how they've used Office 365 with SharePoint. Where you can find me later will be at the bar because we are at the party. And actually, this ride is stolen from the other thing, so Mark Rose will be there, and no doubt he'll be there too.
Maybe on the golf course.
Yeah, and there are some additional resources on our company. Just go to avpoint.com, but please come and see us at the booth. All of your bags have got tags on them with a raffle ticket to win that bike. If you go to the booth, you can submit that. These slides will be available. Please, we do really appreciate your feedback. We want to constantly improve our sessions. Please give us the pros and the cons on our sessions. It will give you a chance to win this lovely, clickable, touch-sensitive mouse. There is a whole plethora of resources on there, which will include these recordings as well as slide decks. I believe the slide decks are up right now, based on it being the end of the session. And also, if you haven't been to the Business Productivity Stand and had a go at flying the plane, if you get the fastest time, you actually win this device. Now, this will not fit in my apartment in New York, but for you guys here in Australia with bigger houses, this may go in your den pretty well. So please go and have a crack at that. And I believe there's free helicopter rides for certain things there too. So with that, thanks very much for your time. Has anyone got any questions? I know we're kind of running a bit short, but has anyone got any questions on this? Or yep. Yeah, so from the question of change management. So change management in that bucket of policy was really around the project management aspect. So and the continuous improvement. So that concept of when we introduce a change, whether it's to do with training or introduce a new service and there's training involved and there's measures of adoption involved, that change management should be defined within when I do the project management. Change management is a component of me introducing that new service in there. We're actually going to talk about change management in the next session in a bit more detail at 3:30, but change management is certainly a component of the project management bucket of policy when you're defining what happens when you introduce new workloads into the organization. Yeah. A guy that does quite a bit about that is Richard Harbridge. He's actually not an MVP, but a guy based out of Boston. Richard Harbridge has a lot of information on change management on his website and his blog. Very useful guy, and also Reuven Gotts as well. They tend to present together, but they do a lot on change management around SharePoint as well. And Dux Raymond Tsai as well. If you can't remember those names, please come grab my card and I'll flick you that details. Did anyone else have any? Yep. Yeah, so the question was, how does your backup work? It depends on the scale of what you're doing. A lot of organizations will snapshot the hardware layer of the document that externalized and also then do the backup of the databases and make sure they're in sync. There is a lot that we do as a technology provider to make sure that happens properly so that you don't have orphaned blobs, as they call them. If you'd like more information, please come to the booth and we can talk you through that in a lot more detail.
If you're going to do RBS, that's a number one consideration. Yeah. If you don't get the backup element right, it's not even worth considering.
Yeah. Did anyone else? Yep.
With your reports, the ones that you're showing us there on the screen, are they out of the box or do you
So some of those are out of the box. So the user activity is out there of the box. Unfortunately, the biggest scope you can get for those reports is at a site collection level. If you wanted to show a report that's cross-site collection, you do have to build your own custom reports. The web analytics data and the audit data are available for you to pull out of those databases. They're the only supported databases you can pull from, and you can report off those yourself. AvePoint as a company, obviously, we have a report manager that can provide those reports in a lot more detail, but you can do that out of the box for sure. The storage growth you can get as well, but you have to do it in a different... You actually have to spin through with PowerShell to get the sizes of the sites and then report off those, yeah. Orchestrator, there isn't, I have to be careful because I'm not sure what's been announced yet. I'm going to say I'm recorded, so I'm going to say no. But if you go speak to the orchestrator guys, they may say yes, but it's coming. I just don't know whether it's there yet. Yeah, it's coming. I just don't know whether it's here yet. But if you speak to the guys, they might be able to speak some hands on that. The other person to ask about that is Mark, who was in the room, but he's bolted. Mark Rhodes. I'm presenting with him at 3:30. He's looked a lot at that, like the System Center orchestrator stuff as well. Is there anyone else? If you do have other questions, please feel free to come and see us at the booth. Did you